Today's Veterans Radio program is dedicated to all American veterans who have served and are now serving in the armed forces, keeping our democracy strong.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
Yes, and good morning on a beautiful spring day in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan. Our flagship station, WDEO, terrestrially 990 AM, part of the Ave Maria Network. We want to give them a big hello with that. And we're on the air. My partner is with me. Dale, are you anywhere where you can say hello? There he goes. And this is my partner, Dale Thronberry.
Good morning, Robert.
Oh, it's Robert today.
Sure, it's a very formal program.
What, do I owe you money or something?
Well, no, since you are a little older than I am, I think, I'm just showing you due respect.
Okay, I like that. You can call me Mr. Robert if you'd like.
Okay.
No,
wouldn't sound
no,
right.
No, yeah, absolutely. You.
But anyway, yeah, good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Dale. And Nina, our tech person, board op, and there she is, yes. Good morning to you. Good morning to the world. You want to say a little hello?
Good morning, America and Bob and guests.
That's our crew. Yeah, there we are. And we're just going into our 10th year, I feel, right? Something like that. But anyway, today we've got a bombshell program. Syria. What's happened in Syria? Who knows? Who knows? I read this stuff every day. And I look at it and I'm going, I don't understand. Are we friends? Are we not friends? Are we supporting rebels? What? And we're going to get to somewhat some answers to that. And we have Mr. J. Robert Dubois is going to be our guest in the second part of the program. But first, as a little bit of current events, the aircraft carrier Enterprise. And on the line with me right now is Mr. Barrett Tillman, author of The Enterprise. He's an internationally recognized authority on World War II naval and aviation history. He's got over 45 books to his credit, including 7 novels. He's received 7 awards for history and literature, and he frequently appears on television documentaries. Barrett Tillman, thank you again for being on Veterans Radio, and welcome.
Good morning, Shipmate. Thank you for having me back aboard.
Shipmate. Oh, I like that. You know what? I was in the Army, but there was a side of me that there was something about the sea and especially aircraft carriers. We love aircraft carriers. We as Americans love aircraft carriers. And the Enterprise being one of the first, and in fact I think it was, right, the first nuclear-powered aircraft carrier is now being decommissioned. Why don't you fill us in right now, Barrett, on what the condition and what the position is of the aircraft carrier Enterprise.
Well, you're absolutely correct that the Enterprise, a whole number CV-65, was America and the world's first nuclear-powered carrier. She was commissioned in 1961, and when she was decommissioned early this year, she completed 51 years of active service, which
that's
is a record.
A half a century. That's incredible.
Yeah, we the people, the taxpayers, got their money's worth out of
Amen.
The Big E.
Amen.
As she's called. And she is now in inactive status at her home port, Norfolk, Virginia. And although she has officially left active service, she has not formally been removed from
the registry. Is that?
She's going to remain intact for probably, I'm going to guess, another couple of years or more before they actually begin the dismantling
and
process.
And what's the purpose of that?
The
I mean, if you're going to do it, do it.
Well, the environmental concerns are enormous because, remember, this is the first time that a nuclear ship, as opposed to a submarine, is being a nuclear warship is being dismantled. And Enterprise is technology. She's mid to late 1950s design was such that she had or has 8 nuclear reactors instead of the 2 more sophisticated, more powerful reactors that other subsequent carriers have. So that's just an enormous amount of work to be done in preparing those reactors for defueling, conducting the defueling, and then the long, laborious process of essentially gutting the ship. It requires dismantling the structure around the reactor so that they can be removed. And unfortunately, that means that Enterprise will never become a museum ship as so many others have done.
Yes, that was going to be my next question. Any chance of that becoming a museum ship? So it's there in Norfolk, and because of environmental conditions, folks really can't visit. That won't be available. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Well, I know that for a fondness, there's got to be a lot of sailors. 51 years of service. She just came up. She just came back from a tour in the Middle East and a deployment. Of course, they don't call them tours; they call them deployments, Bob. And it's such a storied history. I could see where so many of her sailors have got to be thinking right now of their time and of the Enterprise. And that is a very historic ship, and it's not a sad ending. It's going to be fitting. I hope it's quick so that it stays in the memory and doesn't deteriorate. What do you say about that, Barrett?
Well, the thousands and thousands of officers and men who have served in Big E for over half a century are still devoted to their ship, as most sailors are to their vessels, but Enterprise's unique status has only enhanced that attitude. And I know that when the decommissioning or the ceremony to acknowledge her going out of service was held, it had to be on a first-come, first-served basis to a large extent, because there were many thousands more who would have liked to have attended had they been able to, but the Navy just ran out of room, even at Norfolk Naval Base. But there is a well-established, long-serving Veterans Association for the ship, and that, of course, remains extremely active. So it's an excellent way for old shipmates to keep in touch.
Do you have that website? Do you have that handy?
I don't have it handy, but
okay.
If you just search for Enterprise CVN 65, it'll come up. Now, I mentioned CVN 65 because there is also an association for the previous Enterprise, the subject of my book, and that was hull number CV-6. And as you would expect, with a World War II ship, that assembly of veterans is much, much smaller. I think currently there's only about 400 of them who are still able to participate.
Well, your book on the Enterprise has been chosen one of the notable naval books of 2012 that was selected by the Naval Institute Proceedings, and it's gone from soft cover to hard cover. I bet you're happy about that. Tell us a little bit.
Well, yeah, I really am gratified. The Naval Institute Proceedings is widely regarded as the most prestigious naval publication in the world. The organization, the U.S. Naval Institute, goes back to the 1870s, I believe, and it's a civilian organization, but it's a part and parcel of the naval world, because in addition to the proceedings, which is a factual and an opinion and a think piece outlet for naval and nautical subjects, the Naval Institute also publishes Naval History magazine.
Yes.
So there's quite a broad base there for folks who have that interest. And every year for, gosh, I don't know, I'm going to guess maybe 30 years, each May, the issue contains a selection of naval and nautical-oriented books that are considered the most prominent published in the previous year. And I'm always gratified to have one of my books make that list. I think the Enterprise history is the fourth of my books that have been so selected. So it's
congratulations.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Yes, congratulations. Barrett Tillman, author. Google his name. You'll be able to find all the books. Go to Barnes & Noble. Isn't that a place right there? You can.
Yes, it sure is.
Yes, sure is. In fact, I have somebody from Barnes & Noble right here sitting in the studio with me, and that is available. So, Barrett Tillman, thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio, and you're always welcome, and do come back.
I appreciate the invitation, my friend.
God bless.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we're going to be right back. On Veterans Radio, we have coming up Rob Dubois in Syria right after this important message.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University by combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Nothing like the epitome of passage of time than listening to Surf, and that's exactly what we're going to be covering today. Passage of time. Syria, part of the Sumerian Empire, way back when, thousands of years ago, the Sumerians ruled the world. Their armies were undefeatable. And they, where have they gone, if we fast forward right now to today's present situation in Syria? It seems to be the Belgium that we remember in World War II that was between Germany and Russia, and now we have Syria, which seems to me to be the battleground once again. And anyway, in all my travels recently, and I've asked folks about, what do you think of the Syria condition? What is it? What does it mean? Who knows? Nobody. It's being kept down. I don't know if that's for a purpose or that's just the way it is. But anyway, let's see if we can get things started here. J. Robert Dubois, he's a security and policy advisor. He was labeled a, quote, smart power authority while assisting U.S., British, and Iraqi forces in Baghdad. He's a multilingual naval SEAL with professional experience in more than 30 countries. He retired from the military service in 2006, then headed back to Iraq and Afghanistan in support of commanders struggling with complex threat situations. That sound familiar, folks? Do we got the right guy or what? Rob is currently chairman of the Health and Human Services Committee of the Homeland Security Foundation of America. Founder and CEO of, here we go, SEAL, S-E-A-L, of Peace Consulting. He lives with his family in Washington, D.C., and works, quote, anywhere on the planet. Rob, once again, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Mr. Robert.
Oh,
I'm sorry. I'm not supposed to say that.
Oh, you enthroned, Barry. All right. Anyway, yes. I'm reading here a clip, and this is what it was about 2.5 weeks ago that just like piqued my interest. I kept saying, "What's going on?" The U.S. is poised to significantly expand its non-lethal military aid to the Syrian government opposition, and right now there's an arms embargo to supply the rebels with arms. So at that point, we were increasing pressure on Bashar Assad to step down. Now, this past week, 5 days ago, here comes the Hezbollah saying, and that, as far as I know, public enemy number one with Americans, saying that they are now going to be fighting on behalf of the rebels, and Iran may step in also. They didn't say to what extent that would be, but here we have Hezbollah, and there was another article that talked about the rebels being 40% al-Qaeda. Now, there's a lot of issues here. Rob, help us sort through these.
Gladly. Well, first of all, you mentioned 2.5 weeks ago. I'm going to talk about 2.5 hours ago because I've got on my iPad open in front of me an article called Israeli Warplanes Launched Airstrike Inside Syria from BBC. I'd invite any of the listeners to check that out right now. A very interesting revelation and, you know, next phase, I guess, in this whole drama we're talking about right now. There's no direct claim on the part of the Israelis or the Lebanese who hosted them or over whom they flew to get those warplanes into Syrian airspace. But that's a very significant step. When there's already tension existent, this, you know, obviously any kind of actual kinetic strike ups the ante radically.
Well, when President Obama came on national TV and he was talking about chemical weapons, that if it does hold to be true, and there was some accusations with proof, according to the Israelis, that chemical weapons have been used by the government forces against the rebels. And President Obama drew the line in the sand. At least that's the way I read it. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's an appropriate line in the sand, and it's as an American citizen, I have no professional opinion on that because I'm not one of our elected leaders. I do personally feel that if that kind of atrocity is begun by a regime that is willing to mutilate and destroy its own people to maintain power, then there's a communal, I guess it's a global community, responsibility to stop that barbarian who's doing atrocities. Now, I don't think the American our administration has acknowledged use of chemical weapons yet. And I think that may be where we are right now at this very minute while we're doing this broadcast. And I think that, you know, as you said, the Israelis have claimed attacks of chemical weapons. If the Americans are not yet acknowledging those attacks, but they probably have the same awareness of them if they exist, because, you know, Israelis and Americans have very robust intelligence processes. So my opinion is that if that's happening, the attacks inside of Syria against the citizens, and the Israelis are in fact responding to that, then the Americans are going to have a really interesting next few hours and days to, first of all, it has to be acknowledged at some point that it happened, has to be acknowledged that the attacks with chemical weapons on civilians happened. So we can't dodge around that forever as a government, and that will put, I think probably if that's happening right now, that the response is being planned. Like, well, we said we would do something. What are we going to do?
Yes. What would be your thoughts on that? What would be your take as to what would be a response? What would be an appropriate response?
Well, you raised a really important discussion point. And although the 40% Al-Qaeda is something that, in my personal and professional opinion, is very, very hard to pin down on a scale of 0 to 100, because we have to look at definitions. We have to look at what is Al-Qaeda. You know, the Nazi Party and the Communist Party had actual cards. People who were members carried them. I have some of those in my historical collections. Al-Qaeda doesn't have a... welcome, Murat. You're a welcome. You're a card-carrying member of Al-Qaeda, as was accused against the ISIL Heath some years ago. It is not a membership in the sense that you joined, for example, AARP, to use one real, legitimate, documented organization. There are people that are called AQ by opponents and proponents. There are people that either... if I'm opposed to a guy and I call him AQ, it gets me leverage against him because, you know, nobody likes AQ except AQ. However, if I am of those that appeal to whom AQ appeals, then the guy can call himself Al-Qaeda and get cool guy terrorist points. So long story wrapped up here on the 40%. My opinion is that there's a lot of guys in the opposition against the secular regime of the Assad who are easily classifiable as Islamic extremists. And I would argue that this process we're going through right now, or that they're going through and we're observing, has the potential to radicalize a great many more. So it's complex, because if we don't respond, then common men on the street in Syria and around Syria who are Muslims can say, look what America did. Now, the jihadis told us that it was the great Satan. They told us that they didn't care about good people in the Middle East. They told us they were trying to destroy Islam, and now we're seeing an action. They're trying to watch us destroy ourselves. If we do react, then we have, of course, everything that can spoil from that.
Folks, if you have a question for the program, for Mr. Rob Dubois, please give us a call. Toll free, 877-573-7825. Once again, 877-573-7825. We welcome your comments. Sure, you got something to say, give us a call on that. Well, Rob, I'm still going back into this this Shiite, Shia versus the Sunni. And Saddam Hussein was a Sunni. He's disposed. The Shia came into power. That's what I think this is all about, rather than against America. And what they're saying is, America, just stay out. And is that the take that you have?
Not on the part of the opposition. In the earliest days, I can't recall his name right now, but I'll bring it up. In the earliest days of the Syrian issue, 2 years ago, I'm trying to think of his name. I was a guy I was corresponding with who was over there reporting on the situation. A local fellow became kind of the face of the opposition in the Wall Street, the Boston Post. But he and they were looking desperately in every direction for support. Now, again, there's a two-year gap, and now we have today's reality with all the variables of America has not involved itself in the fight. Islamists have flowed in to defeat or to defend the believers, and I'm using these comments of mine are from each person's or each group's perspective. They have flowed in to defend, just like Islamists flowed into Afghanistan to defend the faith against the outsiders, the infidels. So we have all those variables factoring in, and today I would say that there's almost nobody we can back effectively at this point as a Western non-jihadi state, because the secular regime is monsters, and the Islamists we don't want to reinforce as they, help. If we help a bunch of people who are focused on destroying the West to take power in Syria, that's not exactly in our best interests.
Well, I'm still working on separating who's who, And,
right.
And because we do so much as Americans look into good guys versus bad guys. But I seem to think that, wasn't that the way the Battle of Gettysburg sort of happened? There it was at a very crucial point. And before the end of the day, other reinforcements and other soldiers and cannons start arriving from both sides. And before you know it, we've got a full-scale battle. And I see that happening right now in Syria, that we had the rebels, we had the Syrian government, and now we have, it looks like, Al-Qaeda's involved, and Israel's involved, and the Hezbollah's involved, and the Islamic extremists are involved. It seems to me that this is the Bastogne. Maybe Belgium was the wrong metaphor, that it is the Bastogne. All the roads lead there and all the roads lead out. What do you think of that?
It's easy to look at eschatology and, you know, biblical prophecy and talk about the hot spots in the Middle East. And one of them is that, you know, the plains of Megiddo or Armageddon is where it all comes down, if you will, where everything hits the fan and the end of our current identity as people on the planet ends. I've seen that, though, in my short lifetime of 47 years, 48 today.
Oh, no,
nodding at me. I forgot about that. Thank you. In my observation, there have been, I would put a number on it, probably 747 different ends of the world. Little ones and big ones. Obviously, Y2K was a huge end of the world, and we all got excited. 2012 was also a very enjoyable end of the world, and we all got very thrilled and made movies about it. So when I see something pop up in the Middle East, I don't get excited in the sense that it's going to it's going to explode in the sense that it's globally destructive. I don't even perceive necessarily that there's a World War III in the making in these events, because I think there are enough heads, reasonable heads around the world that can say, you know, we're not going to involve ourselves. Now, there are suppositions. We probably would have said that in 1935 and 1915 or 1905 as well. But I don't think that that it's necessarily going the way it's threatened, as is North Korea, for example. North Korea has threatened the end of the world several times. They're going to destroy America with their long-range missiles that would have nuclear warheads. And to date, I got a question for you. Why did the chicken cross the road?
Uh-oh. I don't know. Go ahead.
He wanted to get out of the range of the North Korean long-range missiles.
Ah, okay.
So that's one I just heard recently. I really appreciate that one, because it is about that far they can shoot effectively. Now, I'm not. I don't mean to minimize the threat the Japanese are facing, and even
right. But
the Islanders.
Are you saying
but
that
as far as the threats, it's weak?
Are you saying that perhaps Syria could become a launching point if it gets in hands that are not friendly to Americans? It could become a launching point for missiles.
Launching point for missiles? No. Launching point for terrorism? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because we're being successful in Afghanistan. That's what it sounds like mm-hmm. to me. And we're chasing them out.
Well, that's what, that inevitably happens. We're seeing it now as the creep of extremism. It goes to Africa, for example, on the global scale. The Middle East is not so friendly of a place, because even the regimes who look the other way for terrorism, like Saudi Arabia has done quite a bit, and I'm not calling them out to say that Saudi Arabia is evil and we shouldn't cooperate with them. Rather, I'm saying every nation has its own interests, and every nation has its own cultural awareness. So as you've heard many times, I'm sure, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. So the Saudis have a lot of folks who identify with the grievances that exist inside of Islamic extremist organizations. And they have, in many cases, had friends or uncles who are involved in the organization. But as long as it doesn't affect us. And before an event, remember, before an attack, it's just talk. Before a terrorist attack like 9/11, if you're being rationalizing from a domestic perspective, you don't want to acknowledge that Uncle Osama is probably a major terrorist murdering babies, then it's just talk. But when it happens, then you know, as he did, he was, after 9/11, Osama was removed from the will, disinherited, and it was outside the family graces. Before that, it was tense, but after that, it was absolute. So I think that Syria is a place that if we help Syria to establish a footprint for Islamic extremism, then we are like I said, it wasn't in our best interest as a nation involved. Now, I don't think it's hopeless, Howard. I didn't mean to imply that, because I never think it's hopeless.
Rob, hold that thought right there. We're coming up at a break that we take at the half hour. I'm talking with J. Robert Dubois, our guest today on Syria. And, Suzanne, we'll be right with you. We'll be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Sergeant First Class Paul Smith gave his life to protect his troops. Tales after this.
It's not easy being a veteran.
Coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan, I had been so excited to come home.
But it's harder than I thought.
Join us at communityofveterans.org
and connect to others who are going through the same thing.
Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
On April 4th, 2003, a call went out for a place to put some Iraqi prisoners. Sergeant First Class Paul Smith volunteered to create a holding pen inside a walled courtyard. Soon, Iraqi soldiers, numbering perhaps 100, opened fire on Smith's position. Smith was accompanied by 16 men. Smith called for a Bradley, a tank-like vehicle with a rapid-fire cannon. It arrived and opened up on the Iraqis. The enemy could not advance so long as the Bradley was in position. But then, in a move that baffled and angered Smith's men, the Bradley left. Smith's men, some of whom were wounded, were suddenly vulnerable. Smith could have justifiably ordered his men to withdraw. Smith rejected that option, thinking that abandoning the courtyard would jeopardize about 100 GIs outside, including medics at an aid station. He manned a 50-caliber machine gun atop an abandoned armored personnel carrier and fought off the Iraqis, going through several boxes of ammunition. As the battle wound down, Smith was hit in the head. He died before he could be evacuated from the scene.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
For the past 100 years, Amish furniture craftsmen have placed great value upon the beauty and quality of their work, with great attention paid to the details of the wood. Each board is then hand-selected to match the specific furniture in mind and in achieving the desired look of the finished piece. At Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor Showroom, you will find displays of this fine craftsmanship that you can afford and own. Now is the time. You can visit Naked Furniture at 3570 Washtenaw Avenue and experience this fine quality for yourself. The furniture consultants at Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor are there to show you the fine details of Amish furniture. See for yourself the fine quality Amish furniture. Go to Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor, 3570 Washtenaw Avenue, or visit their website, nakedfurnitureofannarbor.com. Okay, we're back on Veterans Radio. Once again, if you've got a call for our guest or want a comment to make, then please toll free at 877-573-7825. And somebody did a while back, Suzanne of Detroit. Suzanne, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for talking about this topic today. My comment, I guess it's a question, is regarding just all of the upheaval of the different regimes that the U.S. has assisted in toppling. It just seems like one after another, the Arab Spring, et cetera, and now the involvement here. I have not felt peaceful and settled about our responses at all, especially for the Christians in the communities, and an example would be Egypt. Now Christians are being attacked, and it's seems like we assist in an upheaval, and then the Islamicists take over, and there's not freedom. And if our country is assisting to have no freedom for people, then I wonder why we're doing it.
And, well, you had mentioned here that it doesn't bode well for Christians and gun distribution. What is it exactly you meant by that?
What I mean is that we arm these people, and we don't really know all that much. I don't think we know all that well the organization of it, and some of it is not quite organized, and then different powers take over. It seems like we assist with just merely toppling regimes, and then those countries are not producing what would be an outcome that would be an American ideal in any sense. And I give as an example, the rights of Christians clearly are being attacked now.
Stay on the line with us, Suzanne. Rob, do you want to comment on that?
Absolutely. Suzanne, thank you very much for that question. It's important. And you're absolutely right that we as a nation have a history. We can look at very simple examples like bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. We have a history of backing, I won't call it the wrong horse. I would be so bold as to say there's no right horse in some cases. So we backed the Mujahideen, the rebels in Afghanistan when they were resisting the Soviets. Excuse me. And then we got Al-Qaeda out of it. We got bin Laden. We got Stinger missiles attacking friendly forces from our perspective. Saddam Hussein, we've got photographs of some of our national leaders shaking hands with him and smiling and yucking it up back in the, I think, 70s and 80s. And then we had Saddam Hussein, the monster, who gassed the Kurds and had to be deposed and killed. Well, now, of course, we didn't kill him. We let the Iraqis handle that, and they gladly hanged him. So it is a very, let's put some numbers on it. There are about 10% Christians in Syria, throughout Syria, about 75% Sunni Muslim, and about 15% Shia. That 10% of the Christians is, I cannot speak, I should have caveated in the front of the conversation, in the front of the program. I don't consider myself an expert on Syria. I do consider myself able to talk about these issues in a general way because I've been working in global geopolitical issues for the past 25 years. So I'm looking at this as a subset of my expertise. I don't know the status of the Christians today, how much persecution there is active, Muslim on Christian, and how much there is broken down by Sunnis and Shia. I have a suspicion, as I've seen in many communities around the world, I've worked in about 34 countries. I've worked in many Muslim countries, and I've seen what we hear after a crisis in one of these lands. We have always heard it was so much better before. Christians, Jews, Muslims, atheists hung around. They drank chai, they worked together, they bought things at each other's stores, and everything was fine until this thing happened, whatever this thing was. So in this case, and so my point is that oftentimes when we look at history, we look back over 5,000 years through the lens of what happened last year or last decade, and we get a skewed view of what really is the underlying truth about that population. I do feel that anything in Syria right now is sketchy, and while the regime is secularist, they are Muslim-based, it's odd, and so there must be some sympathy for abuse against Christians.
Suzanne, does that clear things up a little bit for you?
Well, just kind of echoing some of the same thoughts, but what has been our interest from the beginning?
When you
then,
say our interest, what do you mean by that?
U.S., the Americans.
Okay, okay.
You know, the United States. What has been our interest to give so much resources and weaponry, and some of those, many of them in Iraq, Afghanistan, have been turned on our own soldiers and those that we have trained them up. We've taken simple people that wouldn't even know complicated military things, and we've armed them, and we don't know what we're going to do with that, you know, what they're going to do with all this you know, all the resources and training and weaponry that they have, but it doesn't look good to me.
Well, I think Susan, first of all, I want to thank you very much for calling on Veterans Radio. And I think that Susan reflects the feelings and the thoughts of many, 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 many Americans. We need more clarity. Susan, thank you for being very much with us today, and do listen in again, and call us back some other time.
And Bob, may I respond real quick?
Absolutely.
This is important because I think that what Suzanne's saying is exactly in line with what the administration is saying. You know, cool your jets for all the those who are, you know, eager to run to the aid of human beings who are in desperate need in Syria. the administration and many Americans, as you acknowledge, and as Suzanne is verbalizing, are saying, what happens if we do it? And that's a refreshing change from the past, because looking at secondary effects is not one of our strong suits as a nation. That's my own argument, my own perception over my time with this government, which I adore and will die for again if I need to. I mean, I'll put my life at risk again to defend America. And I also acknowledge that we are not perfect. We make mistakes as any other nation or any family does. So I think that one of the things that I'm glad to see happening is this very serious look at what if. What if we arm the Syrian rebels? What if we back them actively? What if we put special forces guys on the ground to teach them? And these are questions that I think underlies the purpose for this program and the ones you'll do in the future on Syria is a national debate, or not debate, but a dialogue on the reality of what if, because we're looking at what ifs over Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom right now. We have many, I think it's now in the tens of thousands of soldiers who are full amputees forever. We have thousands of war dead on the American side alone. And those were, you know, those ventures into Iraq and Afghanistan had a lot of opponents when they first started. And I do not fall in that camp. I'm not an opponent or a proponent of the invasions, because I think that, you know, we can fight about things in 2020, hindsight, and say, well, I was right, because my obligation to myself and to, I think, my contribution is to look at what we can do now and how do we prevent the same kind of thing in the future. Now, the other side of let's stay out of Syria and not support them is, what if Syria becomes a massive, what if it's 10 times worse of a bloodbath? It is a bloodbath now. What if it's 10 times worse than a bloodbath? What if it becomes open warfare of chemical and biological weapons? What if Syria is, I mean, if Israel is the only willing party to take action in Syria? So, if you know, we can look at secondary effects on both the action and the inaction phase, and that's why this is so delicate to balance. And briefly, I want to say that's also why we have had to go, and in our national opinion, we have had to take action in lands like Afghanistan, in lands like Iraq, before our invasions, and talking about supporting the Mujahideen and supporting Saddam Hussein. We have taken action in past years because we believe on the balance it was the best interest of the nation, and we look back and say, that was, you know, here's where this went wrong today. So it's a tough call on Syria, but there's a very serious human interest in, you know, nations aside,
yeah,
what's happened to families.
Hindsight is always correct, right? When we look back, well, we should have, we shouldn't.
And everybody was on the right side looking
right
back.
Now, here's
our
something.
National leaders.
Dale handed me while you were speaking there on Christians. Syria's Christian community is one of the oldest in the world, going back two millennia. Christian community, and they make up about 10% of Syria's 22 million people here, I'm looking. Even though they have minority status, Christians have long been among Syria's elite. And they have been represented in, I'm reading this, folks, of the political groups which have vied for control of the country. Well, now we have the Christians, and we have the Sunnis, we have the Shia, we have the Hezbollah, we have the Al-Qaeda. We have a stew of a cauldron. This thing is boiling. Will it spill over? I'm still shaking my head at keeping all this straight. And it is important to us, and it is important that we hold down to have the Hezbollah to be armed. And many of those arms go through Syria. We have about a minute before the third break. Make a quick comment on that, Rob.
I think that what you just said ideally illustrates what I had said before about the fact that there are nations in which there is a functioning stew of types. I don't mean religion only, but this is the topic of the moment. And this is what I argue about in Powerful Peace, that it is possible for differing types of people to work together better when there's a foundation of dignity and respect, when there's a foundation of restraint from force in favor of choosing to be the bigger man, if you will, in common vernacular, to be the bigger man, step away from a fight, seek to be understanding of somebody else before you're seeking to be understood of them. So what what happened in Syria when there were Christians vying for political control, and Sunnis, and Shia. Doesn't that describe a functional system? That's my opinion. That's my thought. And so today we have what we have today, but as you and Dale were just pointing out, in very recent days, both in Iraq and in Syria, there was a functioning political structure in which Christians had I won't say dominance, but they had a full right to compete.
Okay.
That's effective.
Rob, hold your thought right there. We've got our third break. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back with J. Robert Dubois and Syria after this very important message.
You're listening to Veterans Radio on WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
That's called A New Beginning, sort of my musical acceleration now that we're looking to be more positive about. I mean, we've had other crises in this world that seem like, oh, man, how are we going to straighten this out? And somehow it just does. People have self-preservation. But with me right now is J. Robert Dubois, and he is the author and... Okay, the peace movement. Well, why don't you tell us all about your book and Seal of Peace Consulting, Powerful Peace, and Navy SEALs Lessons on Peace from a Lifetime at War. Tell us all about your book.
Well, Powerful Peace, a Navy SEALs Lessons on Peace from a Lifetime at War was released on the 4th of July, 2012. My publisher enjoyed the patriotic element of that, while, of course, the book is much greater than just a flag-waving event. We have enough flag-waving going on by Americans and Syrians and people in Al-Qaeda. I think it's the time to get down to the grit of engagement, to deal with things. And I'll mention also that General Petraeus, just 2 days ago, released an op-ed on the urgency of funding and maintaining and increasing soft power efforts, which means economic engagement, even cultural engagement, helping other other nations with their issues, which means foreign assistance, which, as you know, I think only a month ago, Dwight Zimmerman and I were on the program talking about the congressional issue and underfunding or cutting the budget for foreign assistance. And some of us in D.C. were actively involved in engaging with congressmen and saying, with representatives, and saying, listen, if you cut that 1% of the national budget any further, you're going to make absolutely no significant gains in the tax base or the available revenue for the nation's needs, but you will begin to cut off other essential functions that don't have such simple metrics, like making sure that we are involved wherever possible in the, not nation building, but engagement, so that grievances don't grow up unchecked, which is where we are in many situations around the world today. We have more tension in places where we have not been involved. So this is not a police state or an anti-state. I'm not arguing that we go and fix the world's problems, but it comes back to what Suzanne was asking about. You know, when and why do we engage? And my argument is that we engage more smartly, possibly more in general and in quantity, but never abandoning our own autonomy, our national, our first interest is our own. And it goes back to Washington. When he first left office back in the late 18th century, he said, please don't overly engage, don't entangle yourselves, my nation, with foreign interests. Wherever we have those over-entanglements, we find that we're tied in relationships that other nations that are opponents of those allies of ours begin to take us on and put us in the crosshairs as enemies. So that's a roundabout discussion, but long story short, what Powerful Peace is about It's solutions finding. It's looking for the roots of conflict, digging down in for personal accountability and saying, where in my own life, in my family or in my leadership in a school or in my leadership of a nation or my leadership of military forces, where in my own life am I not necessarily doing the ideal steps to work in the best interest of myself and the greater good?
I see here in your book, and I have a copy in front of me, by the way, and your dedication, for my giant of a father, who has taught me that a powerful man can be gentle, and also for my grandfathers, who have taught me that the greatest powers are laughter and kindness. I'd like you to comment on that.
Well, as any young man growing up, I perceived my value as being bigger and stronger and tougher and more dangerous, and in many cases, less emotional. So, you know, we have this stereotype, this cartoon of what a real powerful, a real strong man is. It's Conan. And in fact, I identified strongly with Conan the Barbarian as a kid. When I was 15, I started reading it, and for years after that, I thought that's the epitome. That's what a man looks like. That's what a man is. He dominates. He ensures the safety of weaker people by using force whenever and however possible. I'm arguing today, as a few years have passed since that admiration of Conan the Barbarian, I realized that Conan the Barbarian attracted a lot more hostility than he solved. So I say my father was a giant. He is a giant. He's 6'4", and I'm kind of runty below 6 feet, in my opinion. But it has always been very gentle. In fact, as an owner of a hotel and bar back in my youth, he had to carry out drunks frequently, and he would never strike them or even twist them in uncomfortable ways. He would simply pick them up and carry them out. Told me about one little fellow who was quite a pipsqueak and got in his face after he was deposited on the road outside the bar, and dad was about to walk back in, and this little guy looked up at him and said, "A word I can't say on the radio, you." And he had this, I'm sure he's listening right now, so he'll get a kick out of this. He had a flash of blind rage and imagined taking his massive fist like a hammer and striking the little man on the head and driving him into the asphalt like a nail. But instead he said, "Go home," and walked away. That's power. That, in my opinion, is true power, because he absolutely could have literally nailed the guy. He chose to walk away because it was the right thing. And sometimes you do have to engage. Now, I'll use, for your listeners' benefit, I'll be very delicate about how I phrase this, but if for the pacifist in the audience, and I appreciate pacifists, I mentioned my grandfather, Grandpa Jack, was a conscientious objector. He was not involved in the wars in his time frame because he was of a church that was actively it was actively pacifist. So I come, and my father, the giant, who was a Vietnam veteran, and my grandfather, who was a pacifist man of faith, each has its own power, its own value, and neither is better than the other. This is my argument, that both capabilities are important. And if you are a pacifist listening and you think that there's never a reason to use violence, just imagine that you are a person, whoever you are, and you stumble on an alley and you find a 300-pound man violently abusing a three-year-old child in any way you can imagine. Now stop and visualize that for a moment. Now imagine screaming at him to stop, and he doesn't. Now imagine putting your hands on him to stop him, and he's far too powerful to move. Now imagine you have a gun available. A lot of people would say automatically, "I put a bullet through his head to make him stop here in the stadium, maybe kill it." But the pacifists, the ones who are ultimately saying, "I am absolutely opposed to war and any kind of violence in any case," are often, when they honestly stop and think about that kind of a scenario, it brings the fact that there are rare exceptions in which violence is appropriate. A suicide bomber approaching my vehicle, for example, shooting him is the only way to protect the people in the vehicle or the children I'm giving candy to on the street. And yet we need to have ruthless restraint at the same time. So we need to be as powerful as we possibly can to protect in those cases where force is required. But in our regular, ordinary lifestyle, a military, a government, a person like me needs to be as positively inclined. In fact, in the Bible, I'm not a Bible thumper, but there's another reference I can pull from it. There's a phrase that says, "In as much as it is possible, be on good terms with all men." It doesn't say you can be on good terms with all men, and it doesn't say be a jerk to everybody. It says quite simply, in as much as it is possible. That means to the extent of your power. the extent of your patience, the extent of your courage, the extent of your humility and compassion, be on good terms with all men. I practice that as much as I can, and I fail every day. But when we take that tack on life, then our environment is not fouled by our own negative behavior, even negligent behavior.
Well, I'm looking here at Section 2 in the Table of Contents on the Mind. On men of God, well, we've got about 2 minutes. Give us a comment on that.
Men of God. Are we talking about context here? I'm not looking at the book myself.
I'm just reading right off the Book of Contents. There's a section there on mind, and it says here, I'll get right to that, on men of God. Context 3. There we go.
Okay. So this is about Kemi, my Egyptian friend. Kemi looked like Amenazohiri, who is the current leader of Al-Qaeda. Amenazohiri was the friend and colleague and mentor and lieutenant, some would say, to bin Laden, until when bin Laden was killed, Zawahiri took over. So now he runs the show. Now, Kemi looks like him. Kemi is a friend of mine who worked together around Iraq. He was an interpreter out there, an Egyptian, with a big salt and pepper beard, balding, had a mark on his forehead from pressing his head to the floor in prayer. And Kemi and I were walking one day on the base, and he saw a little Iraqi boy. And he said, well, why is that Iraqi boy on our base? He's walking with his father and some soldiers. I said, well, that kid was just brought back from Germany or wherever it was in Europe. But he had a life-threatening condition, and the civil affairs officers of the army found him, because the special forces are not all about kicking doors. Kicking doors is a very important job. However, special forces were originally established to engage with populations and build them up from the inside. Foreign internal development, it's called, from decades back. So this was one example of that. The little boy had been dying. I think it was an abdominal tumor that was going to kill him. Local doctors could do nothing about it. He was about 10 years old. And the local special forces commander, who I won't name here, but he knows who he is, said, you know what, here's a check. Get him to Germany, get him fixed, bring him home. Because he knew that it was an investment in the special forces community, in American relations, and in that family and that village. And so when Kemi heard about this, he realized that we had chosen to spend whatever, $15,000, to save a little boy's life instead of buying more bullets. And he said, God bless America. And I used that example in context of Reverend Wright, Jeremiah Wright, who, for his own reasons, said what he said about America. It was GD America, loudly, to a congregation.
I know
because
that.
Because he had the perspective, and Kemi had a perspective. And my point is that appearances can be deceiving. And perspectives are all unique. There are 7 billion worldviews right now.
Absolutely.
And I think we need to be more aware of those and respectful of those.
Okay, I've got about 30 seconds right now. I'd like you to tell our audience how they can buy your book, the title, and how they can buy your book.
All right. Well, Powerful Peace, a Navy SEAL's Lessons on Peace, is available in every e-version and hard copy. They can buy it anywhere you can buy books. It's Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, Barnes & Noble storefronts. In fact, I frequently arrive and find, nope, we just sold out. So I love hearing that, but I know it's disappointing for the buyer, but be persistent. So anywhere you can buy online, it's Powerful Peace. And, of course, at our website, powerfulpeace.net, you can learn more about the book, more about me, more about what we're doing and the campaign we're doing. And I'm so excited. Powerfulpeace.net is just about to blow up and be a completely different environment, a completely different engagement. And we're doing a lot of work around the nation in seminars, teaching to schools, and so forth.
Well, thank you very much for being on the program. Rob, we look to hearing from you again. We will be talking soon.
Thank you.
God bless. Well, there we go, folks. There's another Veterans Radio in the can. By the way, if you want to hear this program again or want to attach it to your email, you can go to our archives at veteransradio.net. Well, that's it for Veterans Radio this week. And until next week, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.